You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Anna Sale in for Leonard Lopate today. Death is the one thing that unites us all. We've all been touched by it. We all quietly obsess over it. Inevitably, we all face it ourselves. Yet for all this universality, we don't really like to talk about it together. That's where Norma Bowe comes in. She's a nurse and a professor at Keene University, New Jersey, where she teaches a class called Death in Perspective. Every semester, Bowe takes on a new group of students and their own anxieties and troubles over death and life. It's a very popular class with a three-year waiting list. And for 3 years, journalist Erika Hayasaki sat in on the class, reporting and learning her own lessons about death in the process. She's recorded the experiences in a great new book called The Death Class, A True Story About Life. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and it brings both Norma Bowe and Erika Hayasaki to the show today. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
I have so many questions about death, and I don't think I'm the only one. Norma Bowe, tell me just from the top, why do you want people to have a more clear-eyed view about what happens when our life ends?
First of all, I really think that people are afraid of death. And because of that fear, they don't get to do the kinds of things they really need to do when someone's at the end of their life. We spend a lot of time denying death. We have a medical profession that tries to keep people alive no matter what. And so people get robbed of a chance to say a last goodbye or to finish their unfinished business. And, you know, at Keene University, we have an urban campus and we have students with unbelievable stories. You know, Erika did a beautiful job weaving them together in this amazing book. But, you know, it's rare, I think, to walk into a room and ask the question, how many of you know someone who's been murdered, and have three quarters of the class raise their hand. So it's a very important topic. I think as we can face our fear about death, we can really begin to live. And that's the main reason why I enjoy doing it.
You mentioned the medical profession, and I find it so interesting that your background is in nursing.
Yes.
I have a family that is really involved in the medical profession, and I find that my parents and my sister, when they talk about death, it's so very clinical. And I come back at them with questions like, oh my gosh, how did you feel? What did you do? How did you communicate that? And they sort of treat me like I'm this poet person with all these extraneous questions, and they're the ones who really face the black and white truth of what happens when people die. But you are interested in all the complex questions that come up around death.
Oh, yeah. And you're asking all of the really great questions, because these are the questions that people really want to know. I can't tell you how often I get that question. Well, what happens when we die? There's really no way to know. No one's come back to tell me, you know. But I do know that a good death is a very peaceful transition. And it's not anything to be afraid of. It's part of the natural life cycle. And certainly, I think how we live our life plays a big role in how we're going to die, like who will be around us and how peaceful will it be, and will we let go or are we going to hold on? And it's not just black and white. It's not just clinical. It's really an experience, and it's a profound experience, and it's a very beautiful transitional experience, too.
Erika, as a journalist, you also sort of came at death from this arm's length kind of perspective of covering murders and accidents and knocking on victims' doors and telling their stories, but not necessarily publicly engaging with it personally. So how was writing this book different for you as a writer?
It was very different. I mean, I have been a journalist for over 15 years now, and one of the first murders I covered was that of my friend when I was 16 for my school paper. And I went on to cover a lot of death after that. I was a New York-based national correspondent for the LA Times when I came across Norma Bowe. And at the time, I had been covering, you know, a lot of high-profile stories. There's a story of three teenagers in Newark who had been shot in the back of the head, and I went to all of their funerals in one day. I covered the Virginia Tech massacre. I was on that campus for 2 weeks, starting on the day of the event. you know, on and on and on. And I think that's kind of the life of a daily reporter, really. So, but you're right. A lot of these stories I was covering as a journalist, and I did get very close to, you know, interviewing the families, and it was an emotional experience. But when I came across a school student newspaper article about Dr. Bo's death class, I thought, you know, that would be interesting to explore. I didn't really know I'd be sticking around for 3 years. I just initially went and did a story on it. And then, you know, I felt like there was so much more that I could write about and experience. And so Dr. Bo said, well, sure, you can, you know, you can write more about this, but you should really take the class. And so while I was also writing about the class, I was enrolled in the class, so I was doing the assignments, I was taking the tests, I was going on the field trips to the morgue and to the prison and to the funeral homes and listening to her give lectures in the cemetery. We sat in the cemetery as she gave a lecture on the biology of dying. Huh. So I was very much a student, capturing this also as a journalist, which was a completely different kind of experience for me.
I want to go back to that first story you say you wrote about death. It's in the opening pages of the book. It was a 16-year-old friend of yours who was killed by an abusive partner in a murder-suicide. You were talking to her the day before, and then she was murdered, and then you wrote a front-page piece about it. But you got some pushback a bit. What did you find about the appetite for what public details to include about death and what people expected you to leave out?
Well, that was when I was 16. I think it's the same today, actually. I've had the similar pushback. But, you know, she was my friend. Her name was Sangeeta Lal. She was 16. She was murdered on the day of the Oklahoma City bombings. So at the time, you know, the news was, of course, every headline was about Oklahoma. But, you know, I thought her story was one that was important to tell. Excuse me. And, you know, I remember a teacher being upset that I put some of the details in the article. I'm very sorry. I have a cold. But
how about you, Norma? Let's leave Erica a moment to cough. But what have you found about when you first proposed to this class and said, I want to take a semester and I want to take a group of undergraduates and I want to talk to them about the details of death? Was the school did they get that was an important thing to really dig deep in with and engage with?
The death and perspective class was already on the books at Kane University, and someone else had been teaching it more in the traditional kind of theoretical sense. And that person retired, and I took over the class, and I revamped it. I really wanted it to be interactive. I really wanted the students to come away with a personal experience, something that they could apply later in life. You know, and the field trips just came naturally.
Let's talk about the field trips. I mean, where do you take the groups of students?
We go everywhere. I tell the students to buckle their seatbelts the very first day when I'm giving out the syllabus. Because it's one thing to read about these things in a textbook. You know, I could certainly talk about the funeral business, you know, from a textbook perspective. But it's quite a different thing when you actually go to the funeral home, sit with a funeral director, hear all the ins and outs of the funeral business, find out what kind of education they have. Find out what goes into an embalming, what goes into a cremation. These are questions we all really want to know, because eventually, at some point in our life, we're going to have to bury a loved one or cremate a loved one. And some of my students, most of them, have done that already. So for the funeral home, for instance, we hear the lecture from the funeral director, and then we go to the casket showroom, which is downstairs. And part of the assignment then is to think about when you're 100 years old and you pass away, what casket would you like? What urn would you like? Do you want to be cremated? Do you want to be embalmed? I make them write their own eulogy. They have to write their funeral plan. So you have to be thinking then. You have to be forward thinking, and you have to wonder, well, what will my life really be like when I'm 100? What goals do I have? Who do I want around me? You know, what kinds of things am I anticipating for my life? And in order to do that, you really have to want to live pretty fiercely and think about all the things you want to accomplish. So we do that. We go to a cemetery. We have an amazing cemetery near campus called the Rosedale Cemetery. And it's like a history lesson in there because you can track the immigration to the area, you know, with the first folks that came and then other groups came. And it's just a beautiful, quiet place. And no one wants to walk into a cemetery.
So there's the historical tour of a cemetery, right. which is I've done before. Mm-hmm. I've never walked through with a teacher who's saying, here's what's happening to the physical bodies in the cemetery.
Right.
What do you say? How do you what is happening in cemeteries as we walk through?
Well, one of the things I ask them to do is find true love in the cemetery, which means you have to read the epitaphs that are on the tombstones. So you get to really learn about the people who are there. And then we often do the biology of dying lecture in the cemetery. So I talk about the organ systems in the body in which things start to shut off first and then what happens next and what to expect, you know, from 4 weeks before you die until you take your last breath.
Erica has a beautiful line in the book describing that lecture about how the mind, you say the mind takes care of the body as you live and the mind takes care of the body as you die. Can you explain that?
Yes. I mean, we have magnificent bodies and they work so well for us, you know, and we really can feel it in our body when our temperature goes from 98.6 to 99. Imagine that our body tells us that we're getting sick, right? And it takes such good care of us that, of course, it takes care of us at the end of our life. And there are certain neurochemicals that are released in the brain as we die. And, you know, this has been researched very well, and there's been blood studies that show that these certain chemicals are released. And it really does help with the transition, the peaceful transition when we're taking our last breath.
I'm speaking with Dr. Norma Bowe. She teaches a class called Death in Perspective at Kane University in New Jersey and is the subject of a new book called The Death Class, A True Story About Life by Erica Hayasaki, who's struggling with a bit of a cold, but we'll try again. That's all right. Erica, one of the things that I thought was interesting is that you note in the book that this class is actually not unique, that there's been a growth in popularity in classes about death in colleges and campuses across the country. What's going on there?
Well, I think there's been a growing popularity in these things called death cafes, which we're hearing about, you know, the front page of the New York Times, front page of the LA Times. There's also death dinners taking place now. I was at a death salon in Los Angeles. So I think that a lot of people are coming to embrace this idea of talking about death more freely. I'm so sorry, my voice is...
That's all right. Norma, are you feeling that? One question I have is, do you think social media is facilitating that? That there's somehow, because there's a more public reminder on our Facebook pages of the people who have come and gone, that it's sort of opening up our ability to engage with death more personally. We're posting remembrances on social media pages. Are we more willing to talk about death now than we might have been 10 or 15 years ago?
You know, I think we're getting there. I think we're moving toward that. I think a lot of what we see on Facebook, too, has to do with the homicides, the suicides, the accidents, those deaths that are so sudden, you know, and pretty intense. I do love it, though, when I see, you know, someone post something about a grandparent that died. It's like you can almost post a public eulogy to remember people. But the best part of what's happening, I think, on social media, my daughter's best friend's grandmother died yesterday, and we're very close to the family. And, you know, one of the folks in the family posted something about rest in peace. And then all of the friends, all of the family members, and all of the community members could post something back and just say, we're so sorry for your loss. So in a way, it does connect us to each other in our grief. And maybe, just maybe, with social media and with our ability to talk about it a little bit more, we'll actually be able to sit with each other face to face eventually and grieve together. Because that's really the best way to heal.
I'm speaking with journalist Erica Hayasaki and nurse Norma Bow about Norma's decision to teach a college course on death and how it's become one of the most popular classes on campus. Erica's written about Norma's class in her new book, The Death Class, A True Story About Life. It's published by Simon & Schuster. We'll be back with more after a break. And if you have a question about death for Dr. Bow, give us a call, 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. We have an expert about death in the house, so bring your questions. I'm Anna Sale, in for Leonard Lopate today, and we're talking about a new book called The Death Class, A True Story About Life. It tells the story of Dr. Norma Bow and what she teaches students about the end of our lives. Erica Hayasaki has written the book and is published by Simon & Schuster. Norma, who decides to take this class?
Oh, that's a good question. Everyone on campus takes the class. I've got majors from every single corner of the university. So I end up with finance majors and business majors and psychology, sociology, anthropology, criminal justice. Just about everyone can benefit from a death education class.
And are they typically in their 20s? Are they young people?
Yes, they are. And how courageous to be talking about this and facing this at that age. Imagine most of us don't do that till much later.
Well, you know, I think it would be easier for me to take a class about death when I feel like death is very far. Do you think it would have the same popularity if you were pitching this at a senior center or among middle-aged people?
I actually really do. I really do think it would be as popular. It's just that we haven't had venues, really, to talk about these things. But I really believe everyone is grieving. Even if we haven't lost someone through a death experience yet, we've lost relationships, we've lost things, we've lost people in our lives, and those losses prepare us for those bigger losses in life.
We've got one of your students on the line.
Good.
Her name is Lindsay Zaccardi from Manville, New Jersey. Hi, Lindsay.
Hi, everybody.
Tell me, why did you, looking through the course catalog, decide to take some time with death?
Well, I'm 21 years old, and, you know, I heard what you were saying before, like, you'd rather take a class when death seems very far for you. But in my situation, I took the class because I'm actually going through a lot of medical treatments right now, and I have a brain tumor, which gives me seizures, and so I kind of see the other side, and I'm worried about death. And I took this class to get a better understanding and fully, you know, understand what death is through this class. And that's why I took it.
Can I ask you, I imagine in the course of your treatment, you're having conversations with doctors, maybe you're having conversations in a faith community, talking to family members. What was different about what you got from this class?
I guess I'd have to say that, you know, between talking to doctors and getting a lot of, like, sympathy from other people, being in this class allowed me to put basically my problems aside and try to look at death as something where I would have to live for it. Like, I understand, like, this class teaches you about death, but it's not about what the textbook says. It's about the experiences and then going out and, like, going to see an autopsy and going to the cemetery, and you have so much more understanding of what's going on, and it's not so scary after that. So it inspires you to live your life, like, to the fullest, and that's what I appreciated most about the class.
Thanks so much for your call, Lindsay, and best of luck in your treatment. We're getting a lot of listener calls. One from a caller named Olivia in Spring Valley, New York. Olivia, you have a question for Norma?
Yeah, it's kind of odd because my mom just recovered from breast cancer about a year ago, and she had to go through chemo, which she said when she was in the chair, she felt like she was dying. And I felt, and she, after the treatment, she said, you know, if it wasn't for you and your sister, I wouldn't have gone through this. And I felt this profound feeling of guilt of preventing her death and making her go through this treatment. And she says she wouldn't go through it again, which is a decision I respect. Of course, I love my mother, and I want her to keep her around. But it's weird, this guilty feeling of not letting her die, of holding on to her. So I'm just wondering, know, what your experiences with that, what you tell students about that.
Thanks for your call, Olivia. Dr. Bo, is that a common experience?
Olivia, yeah, I would have to agree with you. And I think it's really important when someone is terminally ill, and I don't know if your mom is terminally ill, but I think it's really important that we let people go. And the medical community isn't going to help us with that. They're going to want to try to treat people and keep people alive for as long as possible. And I think it was an incredible, brave thing for your mom to say that, you know, and to make her wishes really clear. But I also want to give you some comfort about that guilt because, frankly, your mom still has things to do and she wants to still be with you, you know. And I just wish you and your mom the best of luck. And, you know, things happen and people make a big turnaround. However, you know, if she is facing her death, there's just an amazing amount of things you can do to just help her transition peacefully.
John in North Brunswick, New Jersey has a different kind of experience. What's your question for Norma?
Hi, Norma. My father was a part-time funeral director, so from a young age, I was exposed to dead bodies and the dead in their preparation and, you know, getting ready for the funeral. A lot of the people I know just aren't used to my attitude about death and dying. Essentially, you know, the body's a vessel, and your spirit, you know, at the point of death, whatever it was or is not in that vessel. It's gone somewhere else. Is there any sort of, not warnings necessarily, but any sort of things to be careful of when dealing with normal, quote, people?
Thanks for your question, John. Is that typical people who have a more intimate experience with death that they treat it differently?
Probably, because they know a little bit more about what death looks like. Most of us don't know what death looks like until a loved one is in a casket, maybe, and it's an open casket situation. You know, and sure, I understand where John's coming from about the body being an empty vessel. And, you know, I see it a little bit differently, I guess, because we do go on these autopsy trips with the students. And one of the most profound things that comes from that trip, you know, we put so much stock in all of this around our body and what we look like and how we move and, you know, how we do our hair or what clothes we're wearing. But when you're dead on the autopsy table and they have to cut you open to figure out why you died, one of the most profound lessons is that we're exactly the same inside. No one is any different really than anybody else. The body is a beautiful thing and we're fragile, but we're the same.
A question about how the body works from Bob in Freehold, New Jersey. Bob, what's your question for Norma?
Yes, thank you very much. A very interesting show. I had a friend pass away last week in his sleep,
approximately
my age, maybe 62, 63. Too young for a colleague and a friend of 30 years. And I had noticed over the last couple of months that there, maybe since the summer, when there was a hospitalization, I'm not sure exactly what had occurred, but he was more disconnected or he seemed a little more out of it. I wouldn't say depressed necessarily, but he certainly was slower in responding, and there was some things that I noticed in his personality and his communication over the phone and in person that there was unusual. And you had mentioned the manifestation chemicals that precede that are into the system before death somehow, and I'd like to know how soon that would occur before death, if that's possible, and what manifestations might be evident.
Thanks for your call, Bob.
Yeah, Bob, I'm very sorry for your loss. That is way too young to lose a colleague. Sometimes we're able to see the beginning stages of the death process as long out as 4 weeks. You know, there's these very kinds of transitions that the body makes. And, you know, the circulatory system starts to shunt the blood really to the major organs. And so you see some changes in the lower extremities and the upper extremities. And people do slow down. You know, the body doesn't die all at once. Organ system by organ system by organ system starts to shut down. And so I don't know what medical condition your friend had, but it sounds like his body was starting to shut down even before he did die. And again, I'm very sorry for your loss.
And what usually goes first in that process?
It's a very subtle process, really. About 4 weeks or so, for some people, you'll start to see that they feel cold and their hands and their feet look a little blue, you know, because the brain is very sensitive to oxygen and the oxygenation levels are starting to get shunted to the major organs, and so there's less circulatory mechanisms going on for the upper and lower extremities. So that's sometimes the first thing that you'll see, cyanosis in the nail beds, and a person,
cyanosis?
Yeah, bluish, like a bluish discoloration, and people just saying that they're cold, even if it's 100 degrees in August.
Hmm. Bob in Rego Park, Queens, you've got a question.
Hi, how
about
are you today?
Good.
Great show. You know, I'm a yoga teacher and I meditate. I see myself and everyone else as a divine spiritual being, really have nothing to do with the body. My question is, could you share some of the wonderful experience of people at the moment of death feeling serenity, peace, and even bliss?
Norma?
Absolutely. If you're dying a natural death, and that's a death either of very old age or terminal illness, I'm not talking about a violent death, that's a whole different ballgame, but if you're dying a natural death, people kind of slip into the process. They become sleepy and lethargic, and little by little that becomes a deeper and deeper kind of sleep, and their face relaxes, and sometimes they look 10 years younger, you know, on their deathbed, and they're breathing slowly, and lots of times they have loved ones around them, and there is a lot of serenity and a lot of bliss for people who have lived their lives in a way that they have the ability to let go in a very easy way. And that's an amazing moment, really, the profound moment that you transition from taking your last breath to passing away.
You also talk about the out-of-body experience that people who are very close to death describe if they reemerge from a coma. What's the science behind that? What do we know?
Well, you know, you could talk to four or five different people and you'd get four or five different answers about that. I know as a nurse, though, I've had many experiences where people may have coded, you know, their heart stopped or their lungs stopped in the emergency room and they were resuscitated. And they talk about floating above the room looking down, or they describe this light or a tunnel of light, or they will see relatives that have already passed away, or they do a life review. That's something I've heard so often. It's almost like they describe a slideshow of pictures in their minds of all the different periods in their life from the time they're young until the current time. And most people describe being very calm, very peaceful. And some of them are a little upset that they were brought back because it feels so lovely, you know, the light and everything.
We have a question about planning from Mr. Cam in New Rochelle. What's your question for Norma, Mr. Cam?
Yes, I'm 74. I'm isolated. I'm alone. I am afraid of dying alone. And I saw Frontline where they just keep giving you chemotherapy and radium, and they hammer the wives if they're around. Otherwise, the man is sedated, and sometimes they strap him to the gurney, and they give him these procedures, mostly this chemotherapy and so on, until they die. And this hastens death. Statistically, they know that people don't live as long when they get all these procedures at the end of life. So I have palliative care, which I have on my refrigerator, but the question is, how do you enforce that? How do you keep them from throwing in the wastebasket? And they get $30,000 a day when somebody's in the ICU unit there. How do you stop this and this, you know, kind of torturing people to death?
That's an important question, Mr. Cam. Norma, how do you enforce those kinds of wishes?
Mr. Cam, I just want to say how courageous you are to even bring this up. And I also want to say that, you know, as we are the sole creators of our life, we can also have a lot of control over our death. And you're bringing up a very important question. I would say to you that you need to fill out something called an advance directive. And it will specify on that legal form what you would like to have happen or you would not like to have happen should your heart stop or your breathing stops. And everyone should have a copy of that. There should be a copy of that on your refrigerator. You should have that with your important papers, like your insurance card, because you know they're going to be going for that if you end up in the hospital. So you need to have it there. Give a copy to your primary care physician. And it sounds like you're a little bit isolated and maybe don't have a lot of people around you, but I'm sure you have a neighbor. Maybe there's a friend that you can also give a copy of that too. And you need to name someone as your medical proxy, someone who could make the decisions for you if you're not able to make them for yourself, and make sure that they know what your wishes are. And good luck to you. I hope you are getting wonderful palliative care and that that you're feeling well.
Thank you for all of your calls. Before we go, Erica, I want to ask you one final question. One of the challenges I imagine in writing this book about death is that as a writer in the narrative arc, you're looking for that moment of catharsis. With death, you end up face to face with the reality of mortality. Was that a challenge?
I think it was a challenge trying to figure out, you know, what... Well, actually, when I think about it, I stuck around for 3 years, and it wasn't a challenge in the end because I saw positive things happening out of these experiences in the class. Out of her death class, the students came together and created something called Be the Change, which is a community service organization. And it started with students making over a hospice center in New Jersey that they had actually visited on a field trip. And so now they go around and they've done, I mean, Norma can talk about just all kinds of incredible community service projects all over the country, really. And there's a happy ending. And the students whose stories are outlined in the book, some of them went through really traumatic, horrific things. And all of them have come out of these experiences stronger, and they're incredibly resilient, and they're doing these positive things with their lives. So it actually does have a happy ending, believe it or not.
I've been speaking with journalist Erica Hayasaki and nurse Dr. Norma Bowe about Norma's decision to teach a college course on death and how it's become one of the most popular courses on campus. Erica has written about the class in her new book, The Death Class, A True Story About Life. It's published by Simon & Schuster. They'll be speaking and signing books tonight at 7 at the Barnes & Noble in Springfield, New Jersey. And they'll be speaking and signing books next Thursday at 6 at Kane University in Union, New Jersey. For more information, visit our show page and check out the book if you've got some questions that didn't get answered during this segment. Erica and Norma, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.